Welcome to the Digital Accessibility Podcast, sponsored by PCR Digital and hosted by me, Joe James. I'll be sharing my interviews with thought leaders, experts and advocates of digital accessibility from all areas of the space. If you're new here, we do have full transcript, closed captions and a video over on YouTube, so I hope that there's an accessible way for you to follow along with these chats and get involved with the discussion. The aim is to make the digital world more inclusive and accessible for everyone. So sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy the chat. Today, I'm joined by Heather Hepburn, Head of Accessibility at Skyscanner. Skyscanner is a search aggregator and travel agency based in Edinburgh, Scotland. The site is available in over 30 languages and is used by over 100 million people every month. The company lets people research and book travel options for their trips, including flights, hotels, and car hire. You can imagine the potential for huge amounts of barriers or accessibility issues that could be found within a size or app that huge. So that's why they have one of the best in the business heading up accessibility with Heather. So welcome to the podcast, Heather.
Thank you. That's a crazy introduction, but thank you very much. I'm really delighted and honoured to be here. Thank you. And thank you, everything you're doing in the space as well. I've loved listening to the episodes so far. They've been great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Heather. Just trying to do my bit, as you know. Can't say I've had as much of an impact in the space as yourself at all. But yeah, whatever I can do, I'll continue to. But that brings me on to question one. I guess we'll dive straight in. You really have done so much throughout your career within the space. For me, it was quite difficult to just pinpoint one thing in particular for the intro. So obviously, hence the title, Best in the Business, which you can now carry forward. So the first question is, what would you say is one of your career highlights or biggest achievements?
I do have to think back to just getting the whole accessibility program off the ground. I mean, you know, 5 years ago it didn't exist, and I think when I joined Skyscanner, I was a UX writer, nothing to do with accessibility at all, and it was very early on actually that I realized, wait a minute, Skyscanner are not really prioritizing this, and I just really wanted to do something about it, and luckily found some very like-minded people in the business as well, and we got together and we made it happen. So I think that has to be, when I look back to that and those early days, you know, it was difficult. I had to present to a million people why it was the right thing to do, why we should do it. And I ended up just writing a job description and saying, look, we need to do this. I want to do it. Can we? And yeah, eventually I was allowed to just get on with it, which has been, it's been great. And, you know, since those early days, I think a lovely thing we've done is built up a really strong champions network. So, you know, it's obviously not just me. There's a whole team of champs doing their bit, and I've also now got a lead accessibility engineer who is amazing, so all of that technical stuff he can now, you know, kind of look after, which really helps. I think in terms of progress, it's been so nice just getting the business to agree to things like joining the Valuable 500. You know, that was a huge turning point, I think, as well, that we were publicly committing to disability, improving disability inclusion, you know, so that was a big moment as well. And really any time the company talks about it, you know, if they do a post on LinkedIn from Skyscanner about what we're doing in the space, and anything makes me feel great and makes me quite, you know, proud of what we've achieved so far. I suppose I'm still blown away that anyone wants to talk to me and hear the story. It still amazes me, but I love talking about it. So thank you again for having me. And another thing, sorry, I should also say, the Champions of Accessibility Network, so the external network called CAN, who you're a member of. We have amazing membership base of 1,300 people now. It's just crazy that how this has grown. You know, that's been a huge achievement, I think. And just briefly, that started by Gareth Ford-Williams and Charlie Turrell from both ex-BBC, talking about, you know, how to how to set something like this up, and I heard them talking about it and said, I want to be involved in that. So the three of us plan it, run the monthly meetups, and yeah, the membership base is growing. It's just all people like us, you know, involved in accessibility, interested in accessibility, and as you know, it's such a wonderful industry to be in. Everyone is just so nice, so it's, yeah, that's been amazing.
It is, it's just a huge achievement as well, and it's so, it is interesting, a lot of people don't tend to put sort of, I don't want to call it an extracurricular activity, like setting up a network of that huge. But it's outside of your day job, isn't it? It's an additional thing that you're doing. Your extra is that extra commitment to the space, and it is. You've done an incredible job. It's very hard to maintain something like that, and where it's growing so exponentially as well. It's definitely something to be proud of, and I'm a very, very proud member of that community as well.
Oh, thank you. Do you know, it's such an amazing group that it just shows the need for something like that, because I think a lot of accessibility folks are out there on their own. They're, you know, they might be the only one in a business, or they're on their own trying to get the business to think about accessibility, just like I was at the beginning. And we can talk to each other and we can share ideas and ask questions. I mean, the LinkedIn group we have, you'll see in there all the time, there's questions for the group. And the wonderful thing is people just are so happy to share information as well. There's no competition in that group. It's quite phenomenal.
It is, and everywhere else in tech, because it's not just accessibility that I sort of work within, it's the general sort of tech spectrum. So it is the only space that I see that level of sharing, knowledge sharing in general, but just tips and advice. I think that it can be so competitive and dog eat dog elsewhere in tech, but in this, like you say, it must be that element of there's still so few people in the UK that actually do this as a profession. Mm-hmm. So who else are you going to ask other than your peers and competitors, I suppose?
It's the wonderful thing about having an online network. So for people who don't know, it's a group on LinkedIn, and you can request to join. It's called the Champions of Accessibility Network, or CAN. But our membership is from all over the world. It's amazing. So when we have our monthly meetups and we get people to put in the chat, you know, where they're from, it's everywhere. And it's astonishing that people, I mean, there's people in New Zealand joining, getting up at 4 or 5 a.m., which just every time makes me feel... it's astonishing.
Going global, it's great. Awesome. So to move on to the next bit, which actually touches on that slightly as well. In a previous conversation with Bev Newing from the Ministry of Justice, we were talking about how the UK accessibility space is maturing, but with that maturity comes a lot of sort of top-heavy seniors and leads. So there are things such as events and meetups and apprenticeships that we're hoping will nurture more junior or fresh talent in the space. But as someone that entered it as a UX writer, you know, when you joined Skyscanner, do you have any advice around how we can level out that playing field, just to make sure that we can maintain talent across the board?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Really still a problem, isn't it? Because it's often someone's side project, particularly designers and engineers. If the company doesn't have an accessibility team, it quite often ends up on their, you know, their passion project, which it really shouldn't be by now. It should be embedded, it should be part of a company's strategy to make whatever they do accessible. I mean, the ideal situation is to have a dedicated team, for sure, of specialists. And if you have that, then you have your seniors leading the team, and then you have the room for the juniors to be hired in, trained up. And, you know, they're the fantastic ones. We need them. But sometimes it's just really hard to be given the permission, I guess, to expand a team. So what we're trying to do is really improve the capability across the business. So we do, you know, a lot of training of our people in the product development process anyway, and we really try and, you know, bridge that knowledge gap and just get people understanding, you know, how to do accessibility within their discipline. But yeah, it is hard. It's it's hard when it's a growing area as well, because you've still got those buy-in conversations to have, and you know, people need a team, but then it's not always the case. And then teams, I mean, you know, look at Twitter's team and Spotify's team, they were huge, and then they get chopped or axed completely. I hope that's not, I mean, well, we could talk for a whole episode maybe about that, but I definitely think the way things are going, team accessibility teams that are part of your org are the way forward, and will hopefully be becoming more and more common as we move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is just that, I guess, nurturing of internal teams, or the people that you have that already have those sort of transferable skills as well within, and it's identifying someone in your position that's like, well, actually, I've come from a UX background, and that does tie in quite nicely into this sort of more niche area, I suppose, of focus.
I mean, there's so many areas, isn't there, in accessibility? And I think a lot of accessibility professionals are expected to do absolutely everything, because if you've only got one, then they have to cover quite a lot. And that will hopefully change, because there's so many nuances. There's so many specialist skills. Like I was mentioning, our lead accessibility engineer, he was an iOS engineer within Skyscanner, who was just awesome at accessibility, really passionate, really wanted to learn, you know, was really active accessibility champion, and was the obvious person to move into that role. But then there's loads of other people as well in different areas. There's a design specialism as well that really needs, I mean, there's just so much to know in each area. User testing as well, that's another unique skilled area. Not everyone can do that, you know, so.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work to be done in getting people, giving people the opportunity to actually be those accessibility specialists in their disciplines, make them actual jobs.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an education piece needed there, isn't there? Because I think at times people can think, well, I'm a tester, so I can test for accessibility, i.e. therefore I'm an accessibility specialist. But, you know, that's not the be all end all, there's not one single part of accessibility that you could say, if you focus on that one part, that means I'm a specialist in the entire thing. But then the assumption from the business side of things is, you're the accessibility person, so mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to do every single thing, and then in comes, unfortunately, burnout and that added pressure, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, 100%.
Right, well, I'll move on to something a bit more cheery, and I hope this won't embarrass you or the person it involves, but I won't name them. When we first met at a Champions of Accessibility Network meetup in London, I brought along a couple of friends who work as accessibility consultants to introduce them to the wider network and sort of get them sort of face to face with a lot of people. And one of them turned to me and said, oh, I actually feel a bit starstruck. that's Heather Hepburn from Skyscanner. She's a genuine accessibility superstar in the flesh. I said, yeah, absolutely. It is. And it's amazing that, again, I hope it doesn't embarrass you saying that, but I think there's so many inspirational people in this space. And I don't think it's sort of, I mean, you wouldn't usually turn up and walk up to someone in the street and go, oh, I admire you so much. And, you know, but I think it's really nice to hear that you are obviously doing great things and it's being noticed. It's very rewarding working in accessibility. It's such an important field of work. And I think that a lot of the people that have worked in this space for years and years all have key inspirations or people that they look up to and admire, or could have been the sort of cornerstone for them to go, this is the reason I want to start going down this route. And I'd love to know if there's anyone like that for you.
Oh, well, you have embarrassed me, and I do remember. It was very lovely and very surprising. It's the most inspirational and rewarding industry to be in, isn't it? It's everyone is super nice. everyone is so open and passionate about what they're doing and share the same troubles as well. So I think that's what brings us all so close together. And it's quite a small industry still, so everyone can, well, not everyone knows each other, but there's a lot of people who know one another. And I talk about now my accessibility pals, or, you know, if I'm going to a different city, I can look them up and say, do you want to meet up, you know, just get together. You'd meet up with anyone in the industry just because you've got so much in common, which is just, where else has that? I don't know. It's fantastic. But in terms of inspirational people for me, I have to mention the very first person who completely inspired me was Adi Latif. Do you know Adi?
I do. I've only met him briefly, but yeah, lovely, lovely person.
He is amazing. So in those very early months of me trying to get something off the ground at Skyscanner, we got an email from Adi. Adi's blind. He's also a usability consultant. And his email was so nice, but it was basically saying we were so terrible. But he's saying it in such a nice way because he's just so lovely. And I can't remember exactly what he said, but he wasn't giving us a hard time, but he was just pointing out the fact that we were a bit rubbish and he couldn't book a flight on Skyscanner and he wanted us to do something about it. Yeah, of course, totally fair enough comment. I spoke to him, I called him, we had a chat. And then I went to meet him at a conference because he was hosting a round table, and it was just the best thing. I made sure I was on his round table, and then I introduced myself, and then we could have a great chat face to face. And he there and then showed me the problems with our app, and we talked about how we could try and rectify that. And he is amazing. He's now a good friend. We realise we're both from Glasgow, so we've got a lot in common. And if when he comes up to see his family, some things get to see him up here. So it's really nice. So definitely, he was a very early source of inspiration. Then I think when I was trying to get the programme off the ground, I reached out to a lot of people who were running accessibility programs in other companies, and amazing who's willing to chat to you. And since then, I've done it myself with anyone who wants to chat to me, because it's such an important time, you know, to just get some advice. So I remember speaking to Gareth Ford-Williams was one of them. He was still at the BBC at the time. Kevin White from the Scottish Government, had a great chat with him. And there's a woman, Lisa from booking.com. She was amazing. It was just brilliant, brilliant conversations, so much good knowledge that people are just so open to share. It was brilliant. So I would say they really helped me get things off the ground. But I do, a funny thing is remembering the first CAN steering committee meetup. So before we just, it was an idea and we were thinking, okay, what's the best way to get a network going for accessibility folks? And Gareth and Charlie were obviously there, but they had formed this little steering group, and I was there, and we were on the very first Zoom call of this group, and I remember turning my sound off and taking a sneaky photo, screenshots, because I was so overwhelmed at the people who were on the call. They're like all my heroes. So there was Chris Patno, head of accessibility from Google, Hector Minto, same for Microsoft, Jenison Asuncion from LinkedIn, Mark from AbilityNet, who's amazing, David Sisran from Ubisoft, who's also fantastic. Who else was there? I think there was someone else, but it was just, I couldn't believe I was in the same meeting as all of these people who I'd been admiring for some time. And I just remember being the only one taking an action away from that meeting. I was going to go and do some work on creating a survey or whatever it was to send out to potential members, and that was it. From there on, it was we started forming the group, which was brilliant. But yeah, genuinely, everyone I speak to in this space is an inspiration. You know, everyone is so passionate, so caring, and supportive. It's just fabulous.
It really is such a, I think it's a hub for empaths. I think I keep saying that it's a key part of working within accessibility. I think you have to genuinely care to work in this field. Because there are elements of burnout. There's that in every walk of life and every kind of career path. But I think especially within this, there's the added kind of pressure, because you're genuinely potentially changing people's lives or making a positive difference to people's lives. And the flip side of that is making a negative impact, and no one really wants their products to be doing that. So, but I think the humility that you show is just, it's amazing. And I'm sure that they all probably thought the same. Heather Hepburn from Skyscanners on the call.
Well, Heather Hepburn, who's
me? Oh, it's amazing. No, that's really cool. And it's just, yeah, when you find yourself in that situation. I mean, that was me as soon as I came and met you all at the Cannes meetup in London. I was just surrounded by so many amazing people. And yeah, you kind of have to pinch yourself sometimes, don't you?
Yeah, totally.
It's part of the privilege of doing this podcast as well. I'm quite surprised that so many amazing people are willing to speak to me. So, but cool. So if we bring it back to the sort of general chat around, if we can give any advice to people that are listening, a key question is whose responsibility is accessibility, or who's responsible for it in general? We're in a highly technically led world. I feel that a lot of the time it does fall at the feet of more technical people, developers, designers, and that sort of thing to sort all of this out. But do we have to agree that it all needs to shift left and start at the design phase and put more responsibility there? Or is it even earlier than that within school and college modules or university degrees? Should there always be an element of accessibility taught? What do you feel would be a good resolution or something that will get us to start putting the right foot forward from now?
Yeah, I mean, well, from the business side, yes, absolutely. It's all about that shift left, and it's a nice term that more and more people in our industry are using now, which is great. It's not the job of a developer, as it, I think, once used to be. It's everyone, it's a cliche answer, but it's everyone's responsibility. Everybody has a part to play, everyone in that product development process. So, you know, that's product managers or product owners as well. So they have to include it in their requirements. They have to be expecting accessible design coming in, and they have to be giving their development teams time to build in an accessible way and test. There's a little bit of additional testing that you have to do, and yes, it does take a little bit extra time, but nothing like the time it takes to retrofit fixes into something. We have a number of case studies that prove that point, so that's good. The shift left, yeah, so I mean, you know, starting at the requirements stage, designers have to be considering accessible needs of users, in our case travelers. We have a really nice way now, actually, of marking up our designs with accessibility annotations. So when the designs are being handed over to the development teams, there's already been thought, and those thoughts have been documented. And so the designers are marking up accessibility copy or focus order, or, you know, what heading levels different bits of text are, and leaving accessibility notes. And even if it's not, I've been trying to say this to them recently, is this doesn't have to be perfect, but what it is it starts the conversation with the developers, and then you can work it out together. I think that's been really key. You know, I think it's quite nerve-wracking sometimes for them to get it absolutely perfect, but it's really hard to get it perfect. It's really hard. So that's really important that they start doing that. Developers also need to start building it in from the beginning, and they need some testing tools in there that are just part of their process. That's a big focus for us this year, is to try and embed accessibility into existing processes. So I don't want to come in and make people do new stuff, just like, okay, what tools are we using at the moment to test in? Is an accessibility bit that we can bolt onto that will just give you, you know, there and then, while you're testing for other things, covered accessibility as well. We don't do enough user testing either with disabled users. So we're trying to do that as early as possible. So again, it's not, we're not retrofitting fixes. It's actually just part of the design and development flow. So yeah, everyone's responsibility, but if there's no one leading the accessibility program in a business, it's very, very hard to make it work. So I think there has to be one person responsible for the program, not the work. But the actual the leading of the, you know, building the strategy, getting the right people in place, having some decent measurement there of how you're actually getting on, organizing training to happen. They don't have to be the trainer, they don't have to be the person actually doing the work, but they have to own it. So yeah, everyone's responsible, but it's great to have someone actually leading the whole program. Otherwise, I think it can get quite difficult, quite easy to forget about.
It's that, and it can just dilute itself, can't it? I think if it's then just a drop in the ocean, if it's one person that's trying to do something or for one feature that they're working on, and then the rest of it just isn't accessible. It's kind of like, I appreciate the effort, but it's not really actually going to make any difference whatsoever. So I guess, your thought of, I instantly just for some reason went town crier with a bell, like, here you got someone in the middle of the office, just like, remember accessibility, everyone. But
it's really important to keep, you have to keep going, and you have to be having the right conversations with the right people. And that's not that is an ongoing thing. And it doesn't go away. It doesn't stop. Something I noticed as well recently is the whole knowledge gap actually being a real thing. And you mentioned there in your question about, you know, the education level, where do we start talking about accessibility? Now, accessibility is it's hardly mentioned in university courses. And it's something I've been looking into, because if people are coming in, you know, graduates are coming in, we take a lot of engineering graduates, half of our employees are engineers. They're coming in, they haven't been taught about accessibility, they don't know what it is, they don't know how to code in an accessible way, they don't know how to test. That's a real problem. We have to then teach them. And I've started speaking to actually a couple of universities, and it's been really, really interesting. As soon as I've approached them, well, we have links with Edinburgh University and St Andrews University. So we had links already. So it was really easy to go to them and say, look, accessibility is really important. You know, how do you talk about it? Is it in your courses, you know, your computer science degrees or your human computer interaction courses? And the answer was always like, no, but we're really interested in it. Can you tell us a bit more? So I've been doing some work with the two universities, and it's been fascinating, actually. We've got, the aim is to get accessibility embedded into the curriculum. So it's not really to create new courses or anything. It's just, look, when you're talking about design or UX, let's talk about inclusive design and how to make that work for disabled users. When you're talking about testing, learning how to test, include screen reader testing or keyboard only testing, you know, just include it. But before we get to that point, we do have to raise more awareness in those places. So we have a lovely award that I just love to mention. We have an award going with Edinburgh University. It's called the Skyscanner Accessibility and Inclusion Award. And it's going to the final year student of this academic year who in their dissertation considers accessibility best. So we are going to actually be part of the judging panel on that, and we'll present the award hopefully at graduation, which means I need to get one actually made, but we have an award, we have a monetary award as well, and that's just great. You know, it just gets people thinking about it. I've done a lecture there as well on how to make what you do accessible, and the same with St Andrews. We've done a lecture and we've done an online empathy lab to their third year computer science students. And that was really cool because they're doing a group project at the moment. So we've given them a bit of a twist of, okay, now the thing you're making has to be accessible to a group of disabled users, and it's been fab. So again, we're going to the demos of those when they present to their lecturers. We'll go along as well and try and ask some hard questions, but that's just the start. So it's got to be everything about accessibility. There's no quick fix with it. This is something I've really learned over the last couple of years. Everything takes time. So I think we just have to, okay, what do we do to raise awareness among the students and the staff? I can't ask staff just to include stuff that they don't necessarily know about, you know, in their curriculum. How do they market? How do they teach it? So it's a bit of a process, but one that's really, really fascinating. So we're going to keep going and see how far we can get with them.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. And what a great thing to put your name to as well for Skyscanner and using that brand and that awareness to be like, right, work towards this. Like, it's a genuine award. And who wouldn't want to have that badge? I think it's just brilliant. It's so, so good. And it's interesting. I saw a post from Gigi, who's an accessibility engineer with TPGI. And she posted on LinkedIn saying something amazing happened in class the other day. Our operations management professor spent 20 minutes of a 2-hour class talking about accessibility. And the reactions that she's had on this are just phenomenal. And it just shows that everyone's like, oh my God, I love it. It's actually, you know, people are talking about it in class. Like, yeah. Great. To see more and more, there's obviously the appetite for it. There's so many people that want this to happen. And yeah, so thank you for your commitment to try and push that as well.
It's crazy that it's not happening. So I'm just trying to rectify something and then it's starting in a small way, but it's nuts. It's such an important integral part of product design and development. Why is it not talked about? So we can fix this.
Yes, we can. And love to jump on board. If there's anything you think that we could ever do to help, then we would do whatever we can. But amazing. And then that brings me onto the next sort of question around, it's probably jumping back to a question where we mentioned how things are quite top heavy and trying to get more sort of junior or mid-level resource, I suppose, to help with accessibility. It's the salaries that are on offer within the UK. I think without having that high level buy-in and without having the sort of knowledge of the value of accessibility, the salaries on offer can be quite mediocre. They're not as enticing as purely just a software development or a designer or a UX writer, maybe. It would be more appealing to apply for that job and then maybe try and bring it in as part of your job. But we're trying, I mean, obviously myself, I'm trying to rectify that. The other thing around that is that a lot of people with disabilities will use, there are charities to support people with disabilities. We've got amazing free healthcare in the UK, which is phenomenal. But then the misconception can sometimes be that because it should be as standard, that it should be free. Or a charity should be involved in doing that. So why should other people pay for it? It's like the moral obligation sort of side of things. So how do you think we sort of get around all of that? I know it's a big ask and lots of questions in there, but have you got any sort of pointers?
It just makes me think of the business case that I used to kick off our program and that I have, I suppose, developed as well over the last few years, strengthened it. I mean, the easy one for us was the moral reasons for this. Skyscanner is a really inclusive organization. Our main value is we think traveler first, you know, so if that's our value, we can't really argue. So the moral reasons of not excluding anyone and, you know, being inclusive were pretty straightforward for me, but to get across the Skyscanner anyway, because they were, yes, of course. But the commercial reasons are huge. And I think it's just a case of explaining them properly to leadership. The fact that you hear the numbers a lot of like 1 in 5 people have a disability. It's 1 in 4 in some countries. Many of those disabilities do affect how people use technology. How they use their phone or their computer. And it's trying to put, I suppose, I hate the question, what's the ROI on accessibility? I hate it. And I've still never really been able to answer it properly in monetary terms. But there are ways that you can show, okay, if we've got 100 million users a month, then every month there's 3 million of them are going to be using a screen reader. Do we want to just close the door on them? No, that's 3 million people, or, you know, 9 million people with dyslexia, or there are ways to find those, to break down into those numbers. And I think that when you bring it home to your business and you can relate it to your customer base, it's a bit harder hitting. And the amazing thing is there's so much rubbish out there that when disabled people find a product that they can use, they're going to stick with it. They're going to be your salesperson in their community saying, like, oh, I can, this works. This is really easy. I can actually finish the journey on this or whatever it is. That, you know, it's important. I think disabled people are particularly loyal as well, you know, when they do find something that works. So there's those reasons. There are legal reasons as well. I mean, it's we talk a lot about carrots and sticks, and the legal reasons are very much the stick. But I think, you know, with the European Accessibility Act coming in next year, that's a big stick. I mean, that's important, and that can get a lot of companies into a bit of bother if they're not doing this. So I think these laws have been around in the States for a lot longer, and there's a lot of litigation goes on over there. But how awful to be, you know, to be sued by someone. Your risk, the reputational risk is no one wants that. And that just needs a program in place with the right, you know, the right things happening. It doesn't have to be perfect. It's impossible to be perfectly accessible, but you need to be on the journey and doing the right things to get, you know, to be in a good place for when that act comes in. So that, I mean, if you are operating at all in the EU, that you fall under that act. So that does refer, that applies to us. A lot of the partners we work with as well, that applies to. So we're going to be telling them about this if they don't know about it already, and we're going to see how we can help them improve the accessibility of their products, because in Skyscanner you get so far with us and then we link you out to an airline or an online travel agent to actually book, and a lot of those journeys aren't very accessible, so we're going to see what we can do there. But that law is something that I want to let them know about, because it's coming. So there's lots of ways. I think making it as relevant to your business as you can is the best way to get the buy-in that you need. And actually showing people really struggling using your product is quite a straightforward one to do. And it's quite hard hitting, you know, if you're showing teams who've actually designed or built this thing actually not working for someone, like really not working. That can certainly get attention.
Yeah. I think that's, like you say, it's the return on investment as well. I think, unfortunately, money is usually, a lot of the time, the only thing that will talk. So in terms of getting people to think, well, why isn't it just done? Why isn't it just free? Why do I need to pay someone to do that? It's making them realize this really is a specialist area. It's not just something that, you know, is easy to implement. There's so much to it. And like you're saying there, there's so many different avenues you could go down when you're trying to gain that buy-in. And with the EAA or the European accessibility laws that are coming in next year, I feel like it's not even those that are operating in Europe that need to be aware and prepare for it, because their competitors will be operating in Europe. Mm-hmm. And if they are now accessible just because they fall under this European Act, then you're already losing out to your competitors. So why not follow suit and do the right thing first and foremost? But even from a business perspective, it makes sense for anyone to follow along those guidelines.
It absolutely does. I mean, and all the stuff we were talking about earlier about that shift left, that can save so much money if you actually do it properly and embed it into your processes from the start. The difference is huge in terms of time and money spent on making something accessible. So it all goes hand in hand, doesn't it? But you need people in place who know what they're doing to actually get it up and running properly.
Yeah, I think it's demonstrating the results as well, isn't it? I think as much as we do a lot of the user research in terms of trying to find the mistakes that have been made or trying to find those barriers, I think it's just as important to actually sometimes, and it sounds bad, but sing your own praises and be like, look what we've done so well. Or look, it's sometimes hard to measure the actual overall impact.
Yeah.
But I think to celebrate those wins is just as important to sort of try and convince people they're needed. I think it's we're seeing a lot more, I think, with like Apple, they've done their sort of advertisement for the voice app that they've now got, where it will replicate your voice. So for those, and I just find it astonishing. It's another thing that I wouldn't have thought of as being a regular thing, a regular barrier. But even if that's something that's temporary, you know, it's great to be able to have your voice still there. I feel doing these podcasts because I speak so much. Sometimes maybe I think I should program an app to do it for me.
Yeah. And it is true that accessible design is better for everyone. It really is. I mean, we've had a few examples where we're trying to make something work for different users, disabled users, and actually it's changed the design, the general design, for the better. You know, it's either simplified something or it's made us explain something a bit better, a bit more clearly, and that has a huge impact. So I think it really is true. I think there was a misconception that, you know, an accessible website would be really boring and really, you know, not have any creativity in it at all. But it's the opposite. It's absolutely the opposite. We're just a bit more careful with color combinations and a bit more, you know, controlled with our layout.
Which again is better for everyone, because even someone, I know we both wear glasses, but even for me, I just think, why would you put grey on white background? It's not good for anyone. Like for me, I'm just like, I'd rather be able to actually read what you're trying to sell me.
Exactly. And then if it doesn't work when you're trying to increase the size of the text, like I do this on my phone all the time when I don't have my glasses on, I'm like, no, move on, can't read it.
Yeah, exactly. But amazing. So with yourself, Heather, and for this this episode, I wanted to try something different, and this could go terribly wrong, but it's fine because I could always edit it out if it's I'm joking. I thought it'd be nice if you could ask me a question. So as much as you are the expert, absolutely, I'm not saying I'm an expert in any way, shape or form when it comes to accessibility, but on the recruitment side or staff attraction and retention, I'm hoping that this is a platform where I can actually share some knowledge to the people that are listening as well. So if you've got any questions that you'd like me to try and answer, then be kind, but fire away.
Well, yeah, actually, I'm allowed to ask you two questions.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay. So this is something that I've been thinking about a bit, because we use a digital accessibility maturity model to kind of track our progress with the maturity of the program, and it gives a lovely guide as to things you should be doing to progress through the levels of maturity. I like it. It informs direction for some of the stuff we do, which is really nice. And one of the things that we're not doing very well is including accessibility requirements or asking for accessibility skills or knowledge or experience in our job descriptions. And I wondered if that can be maybe because it can be off-putting for some people if they don't have that particular experience or knowledge. It might put people off applying, but actually it's a really important, you know, we would love to find more people with those skills. How do we get around that?
The easy and ego inflating answer for me would be to work with someone like me. I trapped you. No, I'm joking. So when it comes to job specs, I think it really can be, and there's some statistics around this. I'm not going to get them 100% accurate, but something like 75% of female applicants won't apply for a job if they don't hit every single requirement that they read on a job spec. 75% is huge. So you've really, really minimized your potential reach for great talent. It's slightly less in men, maybe. We have bigger egos and think how we'll slip through, but I think it's about 50% still. So it's still a huge, huge margin of people that may see something and they think, well, they're never going to look at me, so I'm not going to apply. What I would suggest is, in a way, changing the wording, what your requirements are for the role, rather than putting it as a bullet point requirement, as we see in so many job specs. I would put it in the description of what you're trying to achieve. You know, when we are developing any of our new features or platforms, we always want to keep all of our users in mind, you know, and it's using that wording and making sure that it's not biased in the sort of the regular way towards a normal, but just as quick as possible, minimum viable products. We want to just get it done. I would probably look at the wording, the copyright of the job spec, and just sort of say, you know, our commitment at Skyscanner is to ensure that everyone's included. We're looking to speak with people that have thought outside of the box and not just followed ingested frameworks. You know, if you're using semantic HTML and things like that, I think those sorts of things, I'm thinking purely from development job specs because that's usually my niche, but I would start with at least. And then hopefully that will attract people that are like-minded and already thinking that they might not have it on their CV, but that's another discussion to have with internal recruitment teams or the recruitment companies that you decide to partner with to help find these people is, can you not exclude anyone that doesn't have accessibility on their CVs, but as a pre-screening question, before you put them in front of me, we just want to know if they know anything about accessibility. And that's always something I would put, just so it's another string to their bow. And without, you know, that way you don't make it a 100% requirement, but you're in the know before they even get to interview stage, that you can start to just plant that seed and have that conversation.
Nice. I guess you could also include it in the interview stage if it was too hard to get it into the job description itself. But I do like that, talking about it not as a requirement but something that we do so that people who do have those skills will talk about them. But we could ask if people are doing a coding exercise, we could ask the question, one question about, okay, well, how do you make that accessible, or is that accessible? Talk to us about it.
Yeah, definitely. And even if it's just one element, you know, it could be could you magnify this this text, and does it stay, you know, within the parameters, or can you make sure that it's responsive for different screen sizes, and or could you just tab through this if you didn't have use of a mouse? You know, it's actually just the thought process rather than the sometimes the practicality or the actual technical side. It's like, oh, I hadn't even thought of just tabbing through because I always use a mouse or a trackpad. So yeah.
Nice. I might talk to you more about that. thank you. And my other question, we chatted about it, but we were trying to hire a visually impaired software engineer last year, and we did find some candidates, but we didn't manage to fill the role. We've taken it down for now, but we are going to relaunch it, which I'm very excited about. It was challenging, you know, to find people. So what would you have tips for finding the right person and how we make that recruitment process as inclusive as possible?
I think it is a task in and of itself. I think that I've done a lot of work on making sure that the job boards that I post my jobs on are accessible, so that I am still reaching the market of people that may have visual impairments or any other form of potential disability or impairment. Then they are able to get through to that stage where they've sent the CV. They can let me know if they want to disclose. They don't have to any sort of additional requirements they might have. But then I think, it's just you're naturally already going to exclude people if you're just posting them out and you don't have an accessible website. If you don't, you're not using a job board where people with disabilities would use. There is one example, Evenbreak, and I would love to speak more about them in a future episode or down the line. But they are a job board built by people with disabilities for people with disabilities looking for work, and it's not just. It's not just one area of work. It's not just working in accessibility either. It's just that these are companies that are committed to a fully inclusive process when it comes to employment. And they consider anyone's needs. And I just think it's a great thing to have that kind of platform. I think we've always, so we're in a very unique position as a recruitment consultancy that work specifically in digital accessibility. It was something that came up for my boss, the director of PCR, through one of our clients, nearly said them then, but we're not allowed to say who they are. And they just asked for these requirements. And at that stage, we didn't really know how to attract those people. We initially set up the London Accessibility Meetup group, which has now changed hands. However, we had to think outside the box. We had to meet people in person and invite them in and attract them in that way, rather than just put a job up and expect them to apply. You know, we had to ask for recommendations, go out to the network, which you've got an amazing one. So it's do you have any recommendations? But I think first and foremost, yeah, it is making sure that that application process is as accessible as possible, and having that voice and wording it in the right way, and making sure that you get the right kind of people applying for the job. And I will always say, obviously, partnering with someone that's working in the space will help, because I can cut a lot of the noise out. So if it's an internal recruitment team, you are going to get every applicant that you can think of. And if one of the key things you need is someone that has experienced or lived experience or has some form of visual impairment, a lot of people can automate their job applications process as well, because there's, you know, so it's not a nice position to be in looking for a job. So I'll chance my luck. I'll send it out to every job posting that mentions these technical skills, but I might not have the other requirements or soft skills. So yeah, I think it does help to minimize the noise of not, I don't want to say irrelevant, but people that aren't quite what you're looking for. But it's a lengthy process.
We did get a lot of applicants without a visual impairment, and it was really clearly stated as well. It was a question in the form as well, the initial form. So
yeah,
but yeah, I hear you. I think that's good advice. And yeah, we'll definitely talk to you before we launch it again.
That'd be great. I mean, I think I'm very fortunate to know people with those skills that do, you know, have lived experience or any form of impairment. And a lot of the time people won't disclose that as well. So that makes the search even harder, because if you're going to do a headhunt for people with disabilities, or for this example, a visually impaired developer, there are people that may be visually impaired but wouldn't put that on LinkedIn or on their CV because they don't need to. But also, unfortunately, some companies will think, well, how are they going to look at the design of what they've created? You know, it's difficult for people in that position. So I think it's just being sensitive to it all as well. Because it's quite easy to write off people if they haven't put quite clearly on their CV, oh, I'm blind, but I develop code, then we're doing everyone a disservice as well. So again, it's just a lengthy process. I think it just takes a lot of time and trust, I think, as well.
Yes, agreed. Thank you. Good talk.
Great. No problem. Thanks for the questions. They were really good. They were quite challenging, but hopefully hopefully that helps. But that does, unfortunately, bring me to final thoughts. I don't want to take any more of your time up. I know it's a working day and you've got plenty to get back to. But I'd just like to give you the opportunity to let everyone know anything of real importance to you at the moment, either within accessibility or just in your sort of personal life.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's loads of things. Front of mind, if we're speaking to an audience who isn't maybe thinking about accessibility yet or doesn't have, you know, programs in place, I think my message really is just to do it now. Something I've learned and something I've realized recently is it just takes so long to actually make proper progress. So this program that SkyScan has been running for 4 years, and I'm really proud of, you know, where we've got to, but we're not done. We're not nearly done. We'll never be done. I mean, it's an ongoing thing, but to get to where we are has taken so long, and there's so much more we can do, you know, to get to that really great place. So it's not a quick fix. And I think particularly with this law coming in next year, people might find themselves having a last minute panic about it. And it's going to be challenging to do anything constructive in, you know, a few months, even a year, really. So I would just want to, I mean, this is it. I think it's front of mind because we're going to be going to our partners very soon to be saying this. I hope a lot of them already know about it, but we're going to be giving them the message as well and offering our support and our help. You know, how can we help you? But I think if everyone is aware of that and aware of the work that is actually involved in, you know, you can have a push, you can push to fix some bugs. And then the next thing is launched 2 weeks later and it breaks everything again. So you have to have processes in place. You have to have capability in your teams. You have to have a bit of a strategy going on. So it would just be a little bit of advice just to get going now because it takes ages.
Yeah, I completely agree. Just on that point, I think it is just so important that you've got that solid internal communication between teams as well, because you might be working towards a fix for something, but if there's no communication to say, well, actually this is coming, and it's going to just overlay everything. Oh, that's a dirty word actually, isn't it, overlay? But if it's going to just sort of impact on what you've been working for, then it can feel like a real waste of time, effort and money. But brilliant, thank you so much, Heather. And it brings me to the end of the podcast. I always love talking to you. I always learn so much, so I'm really appreciative of you taking the time, and I'm sure that everyone that listens will be equally as appreciative. So thank you for everything that you've told us today and for all the work that you're doing with Skyscanner and beyond that. I'm looking forward to collaborating with you more moving forward at meetups, hopefully some events and things in the near future. As always, I'll share any links to any sources or any links to your social media as well, so people can get in touch directly. Really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. I really enjoyed talking to you, and let's chat again soon. Thank you.